Now we've kind of got to the point where it looks like biofuels and perenniality have to come together if we're going to not only save the Mississippi River from itself, keep the hypoxic zone back to where we can handle it. So we want to spend the next couple of talks working on the perennials for biofuel agriculture and looking at the policies it might take. And to get into the perennials discussion, and I'm pleased to have Dr. Bill Hargrove, who's director of K-Care at Kansas State, to give us a talk on perennials. Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. Some of this maybe will be a little bit repetitive, and we'll also look at a few other things maybe that haven't been talked about so far. Well, first I'd like to begin with sort of setting the stage with what some of our policy goals are for biofuels in the United States. According to U.S. DOE, we want to increase our production to 35 billion gallons by the year 2017. That's only 10 years from now. And that's roughly a five-fold increase in terms of what we're producing today. And that would still be only about 15% of the projected annual liquid fuels that we use in this country. And by 2030, we want to increase to 60 billion gallons of biofuels production, which is about a tenfold increase compared to where we are today. So if we look at some of the biofuel options, and there are not as many here as maybe what Dennis listed on a previous slide, but for corn ethanol, which is of course our main biofuel that we're producing in the United States today, last year was about 5 billion gallons of production. This year, 7 to 8, looks like it will be between 7 and 8, at a cost of about $1.09 per gallon, cost of production. And I've listed here on the last column the energy balance, energy in to produce the biofuel versus energy out. If we look at cane ethanol, which is much more efficient, but of course most of the production is not in the United States, it's in Brazil. Almost all of this 4 billion gallons is produced in Brazil. The cost of production is much less and the energy balance is much greater. Biodiesel, most of this production is in Germany. We produce a relatively small amount here in the United States, about only 100 million gallons, or about a tenth of a billion gallons of production here in the U.S. Most of it is in Germany. The cost of production is much higher, but again, a better energy balance than corn ethanol. But of course, what we're going to be talking about for most of the rest of the talk is the cellulosic ethanol, which there's really no significant production today. And it's unknown, depending on the efficiency of the system, what that energy balance is going to be, but potentially can be much greater than corn ethanol. The limits of corn ethanol today, corn production in 2006 was about 10 billion bushels. To achieve the 5 billion gallons of ethanol that we did last year, we used about 20% of the U.S. corn crop. This year, it looks like for 2007, the production will be closer to about 13 billion bushels. But also the ethanol production is ahead of what we projected, so it's still going to be close to about that 30% figure in terms of how much we'll use for ethanol. And next year, we're projected to use about 40% of the corn crop for ethanol. But remember that in order to achieve the 35 billion gallon goal that we have for 2017, that would require more corn than is currently produced in the United States. So that doesn't seem feasible, does it? So this is why I think we have to be thinking about the cellulosic biofuels. It has a much better and improved energy balance, less negative environmental impacts. It will allow us to move away from food and feed crops to dedicated energy crops if we have the right policy framework in place, and also possibly use other kinds of waste products. They require much lower production inputs, and we'll be able to increase our domestic energy supply at low relative cost. So what are some of the sources of feedstock for cellulosic biofuels? One that's, of course, being talked about a lot is crop residues. As someone who spent, and for all of us who in agronomy and soil science, who spent basically the last 50 years trying to encourage more crop residue cover on land for land protection, this sort of makes my stomach knot up. That's one of the options being talked about. Annual biomass crops, sweetened forage sorghums, kanaf, and perhaps some others. Again, sugar cane would be possible in some locations, like Louisiana. Aquatic biomass crops, algae, kelp, seaweeds. And the one that I'm going to talk most about, perennials, grasses and woody species. And then there are also the possibility to use solid waste, like municipal waste and a whole variety of kinds of waste from agricultural processing and forestry operations. In terms of perennials, especially for the north central region, by far and away the most research information is for switchgrass. Some information on what's called elephant grass or miscanthus, tall fescue, and mixed native prairie. Of course, there could be a variety of other things that are possible, but these are the ones that you see most commonly studied and most commonly talked about. There are a whole host of woody perennials that are possible, especially in the upper Midwest and more maybe in the eastern part of the north central region, but I'm not going to talk a lot about the woody perennials. After all, this is the agronomy meetings. So why perennial grasses? Well, for one thing, most of the area that we're talking about, most of the area on the map that Dennis showed for the upper Mississippi River Basin, and actually most of the north central region, most of the central plains, were all in grass before European settlers came. So ecologically, it's a fantastic fit. We have the soils and climate to grow grass. And that's what was there when European settlers came. This is a picture of the Flint Hills in Kansas, which is still grass, one of the few areas left in the north central region that is still grass. But there are many other benefits of perennial grasses in our landscape, and I'm going to show a little bit of data and some examples of all of these except for wildlife habitat, and we'll just have to accept that they provide wildlife habitat. But soil and water conservation, water quality protection and improvement, and less greenhouse gas emissions, and even not only less greenhouse gas emissions, but net carbon sequestration are all advantages of perennial grasses. So where can dedicated feedstocks be grown? This is basically a map of all the cropland by region in the US, and you'll see of the 400 million acres of cropland in the United States, just a little more than half of it is in the north central region in the upper Mississippi River Basin. There's another significant chunk in the south central states, which is also in the Mississippi River Basin. So in that huge basin that the map's been shown several times today, basically is the majority of cropland in the United States. And again, especially in the central part of this area and the western half, all of this area would be very well suited to growing grass or perennials. In order to reach that 2017 goal of 35 billion gallon of biofuels production, we're going to need about 12 billion gallons of production from cellulosic ethanol. There's no way we can provide, as I've already said, all of that 35 billion gallons with corn or grain ethanol. This is going to require at least 120 million tons of biomass, and that's with a conversion rate of 100 gallons of ethanol per ton of biomass, and that may be optimistic. Or 12 million acres of dedicated bioenergy crops, and that's assuming a yield of 10 tons per acre, which is also optimistic. It's going to be quite a few more acres than that, you know, as the yield goes down, it's going to require more acres, of course. Or 60 million acres of crop residues if we remove 2 tons of residues per acre. And that would be about two-thirds of the current corn acreage. We would have to remove that much residue in order, again, to meet the goal. I'm not advocating that's what we do. I'm just trying to put this in perspective in terms of what's going to be required if we meet these ethanol goals. And to reach the 2030 goal of 60 billion gallons of biofuels, that's going to require about 1 billion tons of biomass. And under the best case scenario, about 600 million tons, or 60% of that, could come from grains and other crop and process residues. The other 400 million tons is going to have to come from perennial crops or other solid wastes. So I think, as you can see, there's a tremendous potential out there. As I said earlier, by far the perennial that's received the most research attention has been switchgrass. And these are some data, some general figures for yield potential in different areas of the country. In the Corn Belt, 5 to 7 tons per acre is a reasonable goal, a yield goal today. Joe Boughton with the Noble Foundation has some improved varieties that have yielded as much as 9 tons per acre in Oklahoma. And I've also seen a presentation by Joe that says he thinks breeders can double the yield potential of switchgrass through breeding and genetic engineering. And we're going to need that, I think, to make these goals. Of course, one of the major constraints for cellulosic ethanol is just the bulk of material that has to be harvested, stored, and transported to some point where it's going to be processed. And if you were, as an example, just doing some calculations for a biorefinery that requires 5,000 tons of biomass per day, which is not unreasonable, or would not be unreasonable, and an average yield of biomass that we're harvesting and removing of 2 tons per acre, it would require a radius of about 50 miles from the plant to produce that, to meet that requirement. And of course, as the yields go up, that radius is decreased considerably, and that also means the cost of processing is going to be reduced considerably. So the yield is really important in terms of making this work economically. Water use is going to be a huge issue. Maybe, again, not so much in the eastern part of the north central region where there's generally adequate water resources available, but especially for the central and western part of the region, it's going to be a huge issue. There's, of course, the water use for processing, which for corn ethanol is between 2 and 4 gallons of water for every gallon of ethanol produced. And usually I most frequently see a mean of about 2.7. It's a good figure for the average. And also anywhere from none to about 1 gallon of wastewater is discharged for every gallon of ethanol produced. For cellulose, it looks like it may be more in the order of 2 to 6 gallons of water use per gallon of ethanol produced. But again, for areas in the more western areas of the region, Nebraska and Kansas, where corn production is reliant on irrigation, and we're using fossil water from the Ogallala Aquifer, which is a finite resource, it's another 800 gallons of water per gallon of ethanol produced, just to produce the feedstock. This is the water required to produce the feedstock to make 1 gallon of ethanol, 800 gallons of water. This same amount of irrigation water, if the corn goes instead of to ethanol into beef cattle feedlots to grow beef, that same amount of water would produce 4 pounds of live beef. So again, that gives you a sort of something to compare against. And I think one of the major challenges for us and our economist colleagues are evaluating some of the different options in terms of water use and identifying how to optimize, especially again for irrigation water, fossil irrigation water that is finite, how are we going to get the best economic use out of that water? Of course, much of the Corn Belt wouldn't require irrigation, so maybe it's not such a big issue for at least that part of the region. Another challenge that I see is I couldn't really find any data anywhere on water use of switchgrass. Maybe it exists. If somebody knows about some, please tell me after we're done here. But I think that's something that needs to be definitely looked into. Some of the other environmental benefits of perennial crops, and Dennis showed some of Giles' data. These are data from SWOT simulations done in Iowa at Iowa State University, which showed that for a large watershed, switchgrass reduced the sediment yield by 55% compared to a conventional corn and soybean rotation. The sediment-bound phosphorus and nitrogen were reduced by 36 and 39%. The soluble P and N reduced by 26 and 38%. And of course, the atrazine was reduced almost to nothing. So again, thinking about those, the data for hypoxia that was shown earlier this morning, and combining this with the other data that was already shown of Giles' data, there's no question but what perennials, in particular switchgrass, would make a significant contribution in terms of reducing nutrient loading to the basin and sediment loading. Greenhouse gas emissions, these are some data from Lemus and Lau, shows switchgrass carbon emissions 1.9 kilograms per gigajoule of energy used. And this compares to much larger, of course, amounts for fossil fuels, natural gas, petroleum, and coal. Anywhere those fossil fuels would result in greenhouse gas emissions anywhere from 7 to 13 times greater than what would be for switchgrass. And not only that, but of course the potential for carbon sequestration. Again, in Lemus and Lau's data, they gave a broad range for several perennials, both grasses and woody species, ranging from 0.6 to 3 megagrams of carbon per hectare per year. And then I've shown some other data here that was from research done at the University of Illinois in Illinois, showing for no-till, we get, just converting to no-till, we get some carbon sequestration, but much better results for going to a perennial to switchgrass, which range from 0.4 to 1.3, about two times more than for no-till grain crop production, and even greater amounts for the miscanthus. In their case, the miscanthus also out-yielded considerably the switchgrass. But again, I couldn't find as much information for miscanthus as for switchgrass from around the region. So in summary, I think perennials are going to be a critical component of the sustainable bioeconomy of the future. especially in the Midwest and in the Central Plains. They have the potential to provide soil and water conservation, water quality protection and improvement, wildlife habitat, and less greenhouse gas emissions, and the plus of carbon sequestration. And if strategic, they could contribute positively to more sustainable agriculture and landscapes. And by strategic, I mean how, where we grow the perennials in the landscape. Some of the constraints and research needs that I see, one big one is still the logistics of making this economical. Again, the collection, storage, and transport of large amounts of biomass is a challenge. I think balancing this with other demands for feed and food, that's a challenge. Water use, again, in the western part of the region where water is limiting and where we get into major political fights over water, water use is going to be a huge issue. And I think the big question is, what are the trade-offs for other water uses? If that water was used for other purposes, what would the economic benefit be compared to using it for biofuel production? On the economics, Dennis has already mentioned that certainly the policies are not in place. The policy framework is not in place, and I hope Steve is going to give us some more ideas about where to go with this. But again, I don't feel like using crop residues is going to be the answer. However, unfortunately, Abengoa, for example, has one of the DOE grants to build a major cellulosic ethanol plant in southwest Kansas. And in talking to their representatives, their intention is to focus solely on crop residues. And the reason, they say, is that they can't pay enough to farmers to provide enough incentive for them to grow switchgrass. But if they're already growing grain, you know, they can pay $5 to $10 per ton for crop residues, and that's just sort of gravy for the grain crop growers. And they think they'll be able to get all the crop residues they can use that way. And so I think it's a huge mistake, but we're going to have some policy changes to address that. And lastly, in the words of Will Ferrell, strategery is what we need. We need to learn how to optimize the use of perennials in the landscape to provide all the environmental services that we're interested in, not just bioenergy, but air quality, water quality, wildlife habitat, carbon sequestration, soil quality, all of it. And I think now our modeling capabilities are getting to the point that we should be able to do this task. We should be able to identify for a larger landscape what would make the most sense in converting some of the land area to perennials and where that would have the maximum benefit. I think that's one of the challenges for our discipline in the coming years. I don't know how it is at your campus, but at my campus so far, this whole bioenergy debate and the research and the education and the extension and just all of it has been driven primarily by private industry and by engineering researchers who are into the processing aspects of this whole thing. And it's been driven by government policies. We as agronomists haven't played, at least, again, I'm speaking for my campus. I'm not sure if it's true for you. But for us, we haven't played as big a role and haven't been at the table as much as we should be, in my opinion. So I think one of our big challenges as agronomists is we need to be at the table and we need to be raising some of these sustainability questions relative to water use, water quality, air quality, carbon sequestration, and so forth, and not just raising the questions, but also providing information and informing this process. Thanks very much.